The Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series.
Hello and welcome to the Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series. I'm Daniel Norcross. In each episode, acclaimed writers, scientists and entrepreneurs reveal what inspires them. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by a journalist, blogger and broadcaster who was previously Washington correspondent of The Scotsman and assistant editor of Scotland on Sunday. He has also written for The Washington Post, Politico and The Daily Telegraph, among numerous other publications. He is a regular contributor to BBC television and radio, as well as Border TV, a keen sports enthusiast and fiercely proud, although anti-nationalist, Scot. He is currently the co-host of the Ponsonby and Massey podcast. Welcome to Inspired Minds, Alex Massey.
Thank you very much, Dan. Lovely to be with you.
Well, it's lovely to have you. You're looking magnificently rugged at the moment, I have to say. We're going to come to that in a moment. But because it's Inspired Minds, I ask all my guests right at the beginning to kind of set the scene and get us into the mood of the theme of the podcast about inspiration and about what inspiration means to you, about whether it is in fact a necessary thing, whether it has meaning for you at all. You might be entirely uninspired by things, or if you are inspired by things, what sort of things they are. How important is inspiration to you, Alex?
Well, I mean, there's a distinction, I suppose, to be drawn between one's professional life and one's personal existence and experiences, because professionally, I spent most of my time is writing about politics for the Times and the Sunday Times in Scotland. By default, then, that has become a long-term chronicle of the era of SNP dominance in Scottish politics and a decade in which, you know, the constitutional question has often crowded out many other things, you know, in ways both good and bad. You know, from a professional day-to-day sense in terms of writing political commentary, you don't really require a huge amount of inspiration, because even in a slow week or when not much seems to be happening and you're feeling it as something of a low ebb and you're wondering, really, is any of this worth the candle whatsoever? And those weeks do come around. You can generally rely on some government minister or some senior politician to do or say something fortuitously stupid or irritating and you know, sufficiently vexatious that you think, well, you know, this is a terrible thing for the country, but it's quite fortuitous from my point of view because I have to write 900 words tomorrow. You know, half an hour ago, I wasn't quite sure what I'd be writing about. So in a very sort of narrow sense of inspiration, you know, what inspires you and so on, to a certain degree, it is the foibles and occasionally the merits of our elected officials. The role of the political columnist can be defined in various different ways, but for me, most of the time, I always sort of say to people and so on, you know, that what you're getting here, what we offer in this office here, is diagnosis of what is happening and why it might be happening in the way it is. If you want a recommendation for what ought to be happening in its place, well, you know, if you want a cure, well, that's a whole different department. You know, that'll cost extra. I mean, you know, and you need to make inquiries elsewhere. So, you know, yes, in a narrow professional sense, you know, inspiration is imposed upon one, if you like, by external events, you know, in your personal life and so on. Then, you know, what inspiring things are, you know, the natural world, beauty, sport, all of the art, all of these usual things and so on. But they are a release from, and if you like, in some ways, a retreat from one's professional responsibilities.
What you sort of described there immediately has me thinking of the lot of the political writer and how difficult it must be, because at one and the same time, what you're trying to do, isn't it, is to have a broad perspective to make sense of these huge themes. Politics is about huge themes, isn't it? But it's also about tiny events that constantly come up and repeat, you know, corruptions or misunderstandings or policy failures. How do you keep yourself fresh for however many years this has been? Because I'm thinking, you know, devolution happened, didn't it, under Tony Blair, so after 1997, and then you start to create Holyrood and you've got the MSPs and all this kind of stuff. So you've now got a whole new parliament to talk about. And that must have been really exciting to start with. At what point did you think, oh my God, it's just exactly the same as all the other parliaments? Or do you not think like that?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, it's true that there were a lot of people who were involved in the campaign for devolution, not just in Scotland, but in Wales and elsewhere too, you know, who said this is terribly exciting. We will have a new politics, a parliament that will be organised along different principles. Indeed, you know, that will be established with the view that if Westminster operates and the House of Commons operate in this fashion, this antiquated fashion or whatever, then we will do something different, self-consciously, deliberately different, and it will be modern and it will be more efficient and so on. So we'll have, you know, for example, electronic voting, which is common in many parliaments around the world, obviously, rather than having politicians troop through division lobbies. And that's all absolutely fine. But it's a nonsense too. There is no such thing as a new politics. And any politician who sells you this is selling you snake oil, because fundamentally, politics is the application of power by people. And people remain people, despite, you know, attempts to persuade us that somehow or other there is something exceptional about this particular group or this particular country or whatever or party, you know, and they are subject to the same temptations, the same foibles, the same pitfalls as anybody else. And so this notion that politics can be done in a new and different and more wholesome and happier, better, kumbaya kind of fashion is a lovely thing to believe in, and many people want to believe in it, but fundamentally it's fraudulent because it requires you to create a whole different type of person, and that, generally speaking, is something that's very difficult to do.
We had Harvey Whitehouse on a few weeks back, who was talking about the seven basic moralities he thought of human existence that you can identify in societies across the world as they've developed, as social anthropologists have found them. And he found there was a particular group of people in Papua New Guinea who, for want of a better word, had a kind of politics that was a little different, actually, that whether it exercised power or felt that power was that important rather than responsibility. What you're saying, or the way you're framing things, seems to suggest that certainly in Western Europe, at any rate, right now, that can never change. Does it therefore really matter what our politicians are? Are they just always destined to repeat the same venalities and mistakes?
Well, I mean, no, it does matter who they are. I mean, it is clearly better to have ones that are honest and hardworking than stupid, deceitful and lazy.
So you think it is possible? You can get honest politicians?
Within the class, you know, there are good examples and there are bad examples, in the same way as, you know, at Crufts, you have good Labradors and bad Labradors in terms of, you know, typifying the breed or whatever, or at least you have ones that are better than the others. You know, and most politicians, not all, most politicians, I firmly do believe, get into politics for a mixture of reasons, most of which are actually perfectly respectable and in some cases quite honourable. They do think that they can make a difference. They appreciate the need to try and make a difference. You know, they are not the venal, corrupt creatures of caricature on the whole. Certainly in the United Kingdom, you know, our politicians are, on the whole, reasonably honest, certainly when measured by international standards. And that's something that we occasionally, I think, lose sight of. And it results in the thing that, you know, what would be considered very minor scandals in other countries, would not necessarily even a scandal at all, become events that in the UK dominate the headlines for weeks, sometimes even months at a time. And that's also a feature of the particular sort of piranha type quality of the UK media, which acts as a sort of shoal or pack in ways that doesn't really apply to quite the same degree in some other countries, some other Western advanced liberal democracies. But you know, even the good ones run out of steam. And no government can endure forever. As a rule of thumb, I think it is generally a good idea to remove the governing party at least once a decade, assuming that is that the replacements for them are within the sort of mainstream of that particular political tradition. You know, it would be very unhealthy for the Conservative Party to have won the most recent general election, I think, in the same way as I think in 2010, for instance, it would have been unhealthy for Gordon Brown and the Labour Party to have won the election then. You know, we've had three big eras in British politics in the last, 40 years. You know, Thatcher era, with a bit of Major tacked on to the end of it, Blair with a bit of Brown tacked on to it, and then there's 14 years of extraordinary Conservative government that initially began, whether you liked him or not, with a degree of promise or at least organisation. You could see what they were trying to do, even if you disagreed with what that might be, under David Cameron and George Osborne in the coalition with Nick Clegg. And then this descent, particularly post-Brexit, obviously, into an extraordinary 8 years that I think it is fair to say have not been handled well, and do show the benefits of having competent people at the top of government. You know, again, you know, some of the things that have overmatched British prime ministers and other government officials in recent years and so on would have tested people of better ability than too, and indeed tested governments in other parts of the world too. You know, the COVID and dealing with the pandemic, obviously, the challenges brought on by Russia's invasion of the Ukraine and the economic consequences of that, you know, inflation and so on. All of that has been very testing for governments everywhere. It was our misfortune that we happened to have ones that were ill-prepared for in any number of different ways to deal with some of these things. But that also reflected the fact that by that stage, the Conservatives had been in power for too long.
You touched on something there, a couple of things that I really want to come back to you on. Brexit obviously being one of them, but also your role as a journalist and where you sit. Within a spectrum, it shouldn't really matter where you sit. But increasingly nowadays, it seems to me that journalists identify with one party or the other. So you get pretty uncritical journalism taking place, supporting things that just to the neutral look absolutely absurd, actually on both sides. And what characterizes your writing is actually a very honest constancy in your position. You don't get the sense that, you know, an Alex Massey article is going to have to lurch into supporting Boris Johnson because your feelings trended towards the right, you know, or indeed that if your feelings trended towards the left, that you would suddenly have to come straight in behind Keir Starmer. So I just want to know how challenging that is for you. Am I over-egging this? Or do you think that the world of political journalism is really quite different from the way it was 20, 25 years ago?
It is different because social media and the internet have changed journalism enormously, clearly. But from, if you like, an analyst or an analytical or a commentator's point of view, it shouldn't have changed too much. You know, there are two types of hack. There's the hack that you know, it's a job churning out the words and so on, and you can turn reasonably or at least tolerably elegant words to almost any subject at very short notice when required and do a professional job. You know, that is the good sort of hackery. And then there is the political hack who condemns in his or her opponents what they would justify in political figures and so on that they happen to support or find conducive because they overlap with their own personal preferences and so on. So, you know, on the one hand, it was scandalous for Boris Johnson to accept lots of money to redecorate Downing Street and other gifts and so on, but it is perfectly reasonable for Keir Starmer to accept suits and spectacles, weirdly, from you know, Labour donors. Or, of course, vice versa, that it was perfectly fine for Johnson to do this, but, you know, Starmer is a venal hypocrite for accepting gifts of this sort. So, you know, that sort of hackery has always been with us and will always be with us because it's, you know, just reflects the sort of human condition in certain respects. But it is pathetic and deplorable and bad journalism, obviously. But, you know, we shouldn't be surprised that there's lots of bad journalism out there. You know, it take any business, any industry, any trade, any endeavor of any sort, you know, whether it's cricket or painting or whatever, most of what is produced isn't going to be very good. I mean, that's just the way of things. So it's not a surprise that there's lots of bad journalism, but it is infuriating sometimes to see what I would suggest is a lot of sort of craven and deliberately dishonest journalism is often actually really quite well rewarded financially or in terms of or socially or whatever. There is more of that probably than there used to be, partly because there's also more commentary than there used to be, and there's probably too much commentary these days. But it is much easier for media organizations to say, well, we'll just hire another, you know, we'll have more comment and analysis, because that's quite cheap to do, actually. Whereas the reporting upon which an awful lot of opinion and analysis rests and depends is a much more expensive and time-consuming and difficult thing to do. And so while we're all journalists, and so, you know, the opinion writers are, yeah, to a large degree, and there's nothing shameful or embarrassing about this, parasites, in as much as not just in terms of feasting off the carcasses of politicians that we've sort of come down and quietly stabbed in the middle of the night, but more significantly on the reporting done by our friends and colleagues on the news desk, because they're the essential ones.
There's another part of this, though, that I just want to try to understand and understand the psychology of it, because we all of us have, well, I say all of us, but many of us have opinions. We have political opinions, and there are debates to be had, whether they be about, you know, how one distributes wealth, how one goes about doing it, these kind of things. And they can be, and that might be partly what inspires you to get into political journalism. But if you're sat there, as you must increasingly have been for the last 15, 20 years, writing things, firstly about the Scottish nationalist government that you haven't approved of, and of a ruling government that you've found increasingly distressing and inept. And you're pointing this out day after day after day. What is the psychology? Does that not beat you down a little bit? Because in the giving of those opinions, you're giving something of yourself, aren't you? And in the fact that the same things seem to be happening, the same government seem to be getting in, do you feel any sort of sense of being personally repudiated by the wider public? Almost like you're not being listened to.
Oh, well, no, it'd be appalling. It'd be much worse to be listened to, I think, or at least be much worse to be the sort of person who thinks that people ought to be listening much more. So, you know, you've got to have a certain modesty about what could be achieved. And no, I mean, in actual fact and so on, if there's a government that you deplore or you think is dishonest, not just in terms of the actual arguments it makes, but the way in which it makes them, that's very easy. The people that are hardest to write about, or the governments that are hardest to write about, and admittedly we haven't had many of them in Britain recently and so on, are the ones that just sort of plod along doing a reasonable job, but not really scaring too many horses, not slaughtering too many sacred cows, not doing very much, really. This was my concern with Starmer, actually, was that he might just lead a bland, humdrum government of mediocrity that, while preferable in certain respects to its predecessor, and certainly a manifestation of a much-needed moment of democratic hygiene, was nonetheless almost impossible to write about because very little that was interesting would be happening. So thus far, fortunately, Labour haven't lived down to my worst fears. They've provided us with more material than perhaps they meant to. You know, what do we want in the fullness? You know, a modest improvement in the standards of living and the quality of public services. Well, when do we want it? In the fullness of time. this sort of thing, that kind of incremental progress and so on is much, much harder to write about because, you know, it's very easy when you've got a whole load of crooks and charlatans and so on in power to sort of say, well, you know, but hang on a minute, this isn't quite right. You know, this is wrong. When you've got people who are sort of well-meaning and not terrible at their jobs, that's much harder. You know, when you've just got sort of mid-table football, it's much harder to write about. You know, a club that is never in danger of being promoted, but never in danger of being relegated. You know, that's much harder.
It has been mind of an amusing sketch that was worked up some time ago about, you know, somebody asking, why is it that terrorist organizations are never centrist? And someone says, so what do you mean? Something like the movement for gradual change, taking to the streets, screaming, what do we want? Gradual change. When do we want it? In due course. How do we want it? By any means necessary within the law. It doesn't really work, does it?
Yeah, no, but that is the secret sauce, though, for good government and for long-term progress. You know, slow and steady is much, much better from a public policy point of view than constant periods of acceleration and then a massive crash and then correction, of course, and so on. You know, the sort of methodical building block type thing, is much more likely to lead to long-term outcomes that are better. I mean, I think one could say the same in the corporate world as well, actually, that you know, you have an awful lot of businesses that are valuable precisely because they are dull, but they are just very good at what they do. You can depend on them, and they get better by 2% a year at whatever it is they do, making widgets, and it's a slightly better widget, but nobody's going to be excited by it. But actually, you know, a lot of the time politics should be dull. That's, you know, one's arguing against one's own personal interests here from a professional point of view, of course, but a dull politics is generally a sign of a fairly successful politics and a society at ease with itself, in the phrase used by John Major many, many years ago. But, you know, from a writing point of view, the key test, I think, I mean, if you can't treat everybody with at least some consistency of approach and a degree of intellectual honesty is a terribly sort of self-aggrandizing term, but a degree of that, then, you know, you're welcome to play the game and be a player in the game, but you shouldn't necessarily expect to be appreciated or valued by too many other people in it.
Now, let me talk to you about nationalism, because it's a very important area that you've written a lot about. And in a sense, there's something, I would say, it isn't paradoxical, and you're going to explain why it isn't paradoxical in a minute.
Well, maybe it is paradoxical.
Well, I hope so. Well, I don't know. Let's find out. Yeah, let's find out. I mean, to a lot of people who live south of the border with Scotland, and let's be brutally frank, you know this full well, a lot of English people don't really think a great deal about Scottish politics, Scottish nationalism. They don't think about Northern Ireland very much, particularly. They don't really think about Wales. Except when it comes to rugby. We're strangely and peculiarly atomized despite being part of one nation. And you are a tremendously proud Scott. You evince Scottishness on social media when Scotland's rugby teams do great things, when I think when Scotland played England at cricket at the Grange and won, you were about as happy as I think I've ever seen you.
Well, that was a remarkable day. You know, that was an astonishing day.
Just to finish on the point and why it seems paradoxical, you're fiercely anti-nationalist. And an English person might be confused by this because they might see the incredible pride of Alex Massey over Scotland's cricket team winning a game against England and winning the Calcutta Cup and that incredible game when they came back and won it late, and think that you must want to drape yourself in a flag and you must want your own independence, you must want to determine your own future, but you absolutely fiercely oppose this. Can you explain the debate for us and where you sit in it and why?
Okay, well, there's a lot to unpack here. And so first, I'm not sure I would consider myself particularly proud to be Scottish. And so I happened to be Scottish because that's where I was born and brought up. I dare say if I'd been born and brought up in Malta, I'd be perfectly happy to be Maltese or a Turkey or wherever. And so on. I mean, there is something intrinsically daft about taking inordinate pride and interest in a particular piece of rock and turf that just because you happen to be from it and so on. Nevertheless, it is also obviously the case that local associations and little platoons and all the rest of their stuff matter, and that you have a degree of commonality with people who share some of your experiences and background and the same sort of cultural, historical hinterland and traditions and so on. And it is not unreasonable to note that you have these things in common, that this place has produced people who have done remarkable, exceptional things in the past and so on and so on. And so it's understandable that people take a kind of vicarious pride in these things. But one should be capable of acknowledging all of that while also acknowledging the sort of absurdity of it, you know, and the randomness of it, that you happen to be here in this particular geographical location at this particular point in time. That is something over which you have no control. And so one should just be aware of that, you know, without making too much of it. Within the Scottish context, though, I mean, Scotland is a sort of ambiguous place, a contested place in many respects, because, you know, it is no surprise. I mean, this has become a convention within Scottish literature, for instance, that this notion, the notion of a doubled identity, of duality, so accepted within Scotland's sort of national psyche or the imaginative idea of Scotland that it borders on cliche now. But, you know, you think of Robert Louis Stevenson and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, although it's set in London, it's really set in Edinburgh, and it's really, you know, it's a very, very Scottish novel. The same with James Hogg's Confessions of a Justified Sinner. Again, you have a sort of doubled identity. And this is a theme that runs through Scottish literature, Scottish history, and so on, because you have this thing that you have a keen awareness of Scotland as a nation, and then an argument about whether does a nation also have to be a state? And that has been effectively what the argument has been in Scotland for the last however many decades, really ever since the rise of the modern SNP. Because the idea of independence has always had a certain amount of appeal, even to people who did not vote in favour of independence in the referendum in 2014. But you could understand why, all things being equal, yes, of course, it would be lovely. The challenge for the independence movement has always been to persuade people that actually, yes, now, right now, all things are equal. Not only all things are equal, but we would be better off independent. And they came very close to doing that in 2014, and they came close to doing it for brief moments after Brexit as well, where there was a Brexit bounce for the SNP, because the differential nature of the Brexit vote, with England voting to leave, Scotland voting to remain, you know, that created a clear political argument for reopening the national question for a second referendum on independence. But that bounce was smaller than the SNP thought and didn't last as long, because it turned out that Brexit turned out to be quite a difficult process and an exhausting one as well. So exhausting that people began to think, well, do we really want to have another go on the constitutional merry-go-round? But anyway, to come back from that, you know, in 2014, the argument was not between Scottish people and non-Scottish people. The argument was between people in Scotland who don't feel much of a British identity and don't accept it, and those who are equally comfortable being British and Scottish at the same time, that you can have this sort of doubled arrangement without either costing or impinging upon the other parts of your identity. And so to that extent, in a curious way, it's actually extremely important for unionists in Scotland to go along to Murrayfield or to Hampden, and for Scotland to do well, particularly in games against England. It's a kind of assertion of identity within a greater British sense. You know, I mean, identity politics wasn't the only thing driving the referendum, and it was often an unacknowledged one. But I think it was there as a sub underpinning a lot of the other things, even if the voters who decided the outcome in the independence referendum had very little emotional attachment to the Union flag or the institutions of the United Kingdom, possible exception of the monarchy, but even then quite weakly. They were making a rational choice based on their own personal, professional, and often economic interest. So that, you know, did the risks of independence outweigh the rewards? In the end, enough of those voters conceded that they did, or concluded that they did. You know, there is no contradiction between, for instance, supporting the Scottish rugby team and the English cricket team. You know, there are an awful lot of people who are very, very happy to do that. There are also plenty of people I know and friends who vote SNP, who support Scottish independence, but nevertheless, when it comes to international cricket, particularly obviously Test match cricket, are dedicated, devoted followers of the English team. You know, and they go to Old Trafford or Headingley or the Lords or the Oval every year for a Test match, and they support England. You know, there are also people who take the, if you like, the more sort of football-styled approach and support whoever happens to be playing against England. You know, this notion of Scotland versus Britain, you know, the national question is an internal one. It's a family dispute in many ways. And you have one side that's saying that the articulation of Scottishness requires the nation of Scotland to also be a state. And then you have the other side that effectively, although they don't really talk about this in public, says, well, but I'm quite comfortable, you know, with a nationality that doesn't need to be buttressed by, you know, a central bank, a social security system, you know, passports, whatever. You know, it could be more relaxed about this in certain respects. Even when it comes to things like culture and so on, you know, so you've got, you know, say somebody like Philip Larkin. Now, he's a very, very English poet. I quite see how Larkin, like, say, P.G. Woodhouse, touches something about Englishness more deeply than it touches people in Wales, Scotland, Ireland, whatever. But it still belongs to all of us. That's how I see the United Kingdom in many ways, that there are, you know, aspects of it that are closer to individual parts of us, but collectively is our, you know, as I say, collective inheritance, if you like. Drawing distinctions between these in a political sense is unnecessary and sort of otiose.
You wrote back in 2021, and I don't want to hurl articles at you because you write so many articles and you blog so much that you, I don't know if you remember each one you've written.
Oh God, no!
But we'll see. We'll test it out. You wrote in The Spectator back in 2021 a piece that was headlined, at any rate, "Scottish nationalism is no better than any other kind." And in the article, the implication is that Scottish nationalists think that their nationalism isn't the same nationalism as English nationalism, for example, which has a rather ugly feel to it. Its figureheads are people like Nigel Farage, whereas Nicola Sturgeon was leading a nationalism which is completely different. Firstly, what precisely did you mean by that? And secondly, why do you think it is that Scottish nationalism manages to present itself in a way that is less ugly, perhaps?
Well, I mean, nationalism is always a reaction against something. And let's go back to sport. So in the 1970s, if you had marauding, drunken, badly behaved football supporters, there was quite a good chance that at least some of the time they'd be Scotland's supporters descending on London for the match against England at Wembley, or it'd be Rangers and Celtic supporters rioting at Hampden, as they did famously in a Scottish Cup final. And then, you know, you have the thing, well, in the English football supporters, particularly on tour in Europe and so on, start behaving appallingly. And so suddenly you get a transformation in the behaviour of Scottish football supporters to differentiate and to distinguish themselves from English football supporters and hooligans. And so then you get the creation of the Tartan Army and the myth, the sense of them as being everybody's pals and so on, and the best fans in the world and blah, 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 blah. But it's a reaction to English behaviour in many ways. And one of the stories of the United Kingdom in certain respects, obviously, over the last 300 years has been, and I would say actually one of the demonstrations of the UK's success, but also one of the things that makes it a very unusual country, is that it has simultaneously been a state of unions, a union state in certain ways, but within that has allowed plenty of space for the maintenance and encouragement of other national identities within it that come together to form whatever Britishness is. And that, you know, that could be Englishness, obviously it's Scottishness, but the, you know, Scotland remaining Scotland is one of the great achievements of the Union. The fact that it isn't just an incorporation or it hasn't been folded into England. And so to that extent, even Unionist Scots tend to have a streak of nationalism in them, because maintaining and protecting Scottish perquisites is quite important. You can trace this all the way back to, you know, say Sir Walter Scott, for instance, launched a vigorous campaign to defend the right of Scottish banks to continue printing their own banknotes. He was successful in this, but it had been proposed that they shouldn't be allowed this. It'd be much simpler, tidier, and so on if it was just the Bank of England that did this. But that would have been an infringement on sort of, you know, as I say, Scottish rights. And so Scott opposed it, although he was a dedicated, in some ways, most foremost Unionist that we have, and somebody who did an awful lot to create the idea of Britain itself. You know, Scottish, that's the sort of backdrop for Scottish nationalism. And as much as, you know, John Buchan, you know, again, another novelist and so on, you know, he once said in the House of Commons when he was an MP for the Scottish universities, you know, that every Scotsman should be a Scottish nationalist. Now, he didn't mean by that that Scotland had to be an independent state. He just meant that every Scotsman should remember Scotland's particular national interest at times and recall that this would on occasion be distinct from interests elsewhere within the UK, particularly London. Scottish nationalism is a reaction against English nationalism in some ways, but it's also something with a long, long thread in our history. And at its best, the SNP and the Scottish nationalist movement are what I would consider the most boring nationalist movement in Europe. There is an understanding at senior levels of the SNP, and has been for a long time, to give them credit, that the sort of braveheart and bagpipes, it doesn't impress anyone. Scotland is not an oppressed nation. It is not discriminated against. There are very few, if any, things that people in England can do in terms of leading their lives and seeking, you know, more fulfilled, happier, prosperous lives that people in Scotland can't do. There is no boot of Westminster oppression. And so it is daft to ask people to believe that there is. It asks people to contradict or to refuse to believe the evidence of their own lives. And that is rarely a sensible platform for people seeking political advancement to pursue. At the same time, there is this caricature of English politics. I mean, it's like all caricatures, it contains a degree of truth, that England is a sort of right-wing and heartless polity. And so by contrast, by distinction, in order to define ourselves, Scotland must be a progressive, liberal, and welcoming kind of place. Again, there is a degree of truth in that. Scottish society is a little bit more left-wing than English society, but it is a difference of degree rather than kind. And we have all kinds of polling and statistical evidence to demonstrate that you know, it's like one notch further along on the belt. It's not a completely different type of belt. And one is sometimes then, you know, led to wonder that if it was the other way around, if England was the slightly more left of centre society, would Scotland seek to define itself by being slightly more right-wing? And I suspect the chances are that that would indeed be the case, because England is the great other, obviously. And one of the things that we see in devolution, actually, is a narrowing of horizons in certain respects, in as much as, okay, there are problems in the Scottish NHS. Well, there are problems everywhere in the NHS. So what matters is, are these problems more severe than the problems in the NHS in England or the NHS in Wales? And if it's, you know, 0.5% better in Scotland, then happy days. And conversely, if it's 0.5% worse, then, oh, woe and ignominy and shame upon us all and all the rest of it. And both sides of the argument play this, both the government and the opposition, you know, that England is the constant measuring thing. So if we're slightly better than England, then ways like us, it's Bannockburn all over again. If we're slightly worse than England, then, oh, can we know do anything right? It's Flodden once more. And you know, this is somewhat unhealthy, but it's also understandable in the United Kingdom, where, you know, 85% of the people who live in the UK are in England. So it is always going to be the elephant in the room, in the same way as Trudeau Senior said that of Canada and its relationship with the United States of America. You know, it is always there. It is the elephant in the bed, and and so on, you know. And most of the time it's perfectly comfortable. But occasionally, you know, if the elephant starts rolling over, you know, it can squash an awful lot of smaller creatures that are lying alongside it. And that is one of the things that people in Scotland are always aware of, and understandably. But, you know, fundamentally, all forms of nationalism, to return to the point at which it began a long time ago, too long ago, I appreciate that, you're defining yourself against other things. And so to that extent, all forms of nationalism are the same, whether, you know, it's just the identity of what you're defining yourself against is different. And it's all based fundamentally on notions of superiority, which is fine if you actually are superior. But when there's precious little evidence for that superiority and so on, then the constant assertions of this sort of better, kinder, gentler, blah, 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 you know, nicer place and so on, become somewhat irksome after a while.
Well, one thing we can say about Scotland, it is a spectacularly beautiful place. You find yourself on Jura, where you go frequently. You post pictures of the most gorgeous scenery. Before we finish, or as we finish, really, what is it that draws you to this land? Because it's obviously something that's magical. And perhaps you did mention when we were talking about inspiration right at the very beginning that things like sport and culture, music and the natural world can be inspirational. Let's finish with you and Jura and the islands and the highlands, which you spend so much time on.
Well, yeah, I mean, Scotland is a strikingly beautiful place, but it is also, I mean, this is somewhat sort of selfish, so it is also pleasingly empty.
That matters to you. That's important to you, is it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there are you know, lots of places that are beautiful. I mean, the massive Centrale in France and so on, and the Cévennes and so on is very, very beautiful and so on. But they're tough places to live, tough places to make a living in the modern world. And so they're also, you know, gratifyingly empty. I think it's really the solitude, actually, that I find particularly attractive about the Hebrides and the Highlands. And I appreciate that that's a somewhat sort of selfish way of looking at it. But there is the clarity that you get from a day out in the hills or a day spent, you know, fishing for brown trout on the loch, even if they're small fish or if they're not playing ball, it doesn't really matter. It is that that sense of distance and space that is immensely rewarding, and sometimes, you know, a little humbling in some ways, that this place has endured for an awful long time. It puts your own concerns into a degree of necessary perspective, that the whatever your own sort of problems or difficulties or current obsessions, in the grand scheme of historic and geographical and geological time and all the rest of it, you know, they don't really amount to very much. And one of the great advantages of the countryside, and I think you could say the same about, you know, large portions of the English countryside too, whether it's the North York Moors or the Downs or whatever, is that sense of time and space, which, you know, a person can lose themselves. And again, providing that sense of perspective and peacefulness that is harder to achieve, I think, in the great cities, regardless of how magnificent they are, and that, you know, the many consolations that come with metropolitan life. But, you know, you do miss that peace and quiet from time to time. And so to be able to escape to somewhere as beautiful, but also as pleasingly empty as the west coast of Scotland is, you know, something one's very fortunate to have the ability to do. It does also allow you to have a degree of clarity of thinking in the professional life as well. You know, that it's a sort of great way of detoxifying yourself and so on, and realizing that some of the stuff we write about actually probably doesn't matter very much. And that is one of the problems with political journalism as well, is that, you know, you can get fixated on stuff that when viewed from a more sensible perspective, you discover doesn't really actually amount to very much. And because the big challenges, again, that we face in this country are the same as the big challenges that, you know, every other Western liberal democracy faces. And one of the things that we do have that we sometimes lose sight of in politics, I think, and this includes political journalism, politics is not really an argument about ends in successful democratic countries. It is an argument about the means to those ends. And that, in theory, ought to allow for the creation of spaces where good faith engagement and discussion should be more easily achieved than sadly sometimes seems to be the case.
Maybe we just need to send everybody off to Jura and they can work it all out.
No,
in their own time.
I'm not
space.
Sure the full-time residents would necessarily appreciate the relocation of Parliament here.
I think that's where we finish it. Alex Massey, thank you so much for joining us. You've been listening to the latest episode of the Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series with me, Daniel Norcross, and my fabulous guest, Alex Massey. You can listen to previous episodes of the series on all major podcast platforms. And if you enjoyed listening, don't forget to like or subscribe. To find out more about the series, just go to rathbones.com.
The Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series, now available on all podcast platforms and at rathbones.com.
The opinions expressed by guests on Rathbones Inspired Minds are personal and will not necessarily reflect the views of Rathbones Investment Management, nor will they constitute a recommendation or advice to buy or sell any product or service on behalf of Rathbones Group PLC.